Thank you for listening to the sermon podcast from Grace Anglican Church of Grove City, Pennsylvania. Our goal in every sermon is to proclaim the bold truth of the Word of God, especially the undiluted grace of Jesus Christ. If you want to learn more about our church, check out our website at graceanglicanonline.com.
One man come in the name of love. One man come and go.
Today we are concluding our sermon series on the Ten Commandments, concluding, of course, with the Tenth Commandment about coveting. When I was at Eastern University, I went to a nearby college for art courses, and in one of those art courses, we were invited to depict a sin. Choose a sin, any one of our favorites, and then take a famous masterpiece and alter that masterpiece in such a way that it would communicate something about this particular sin. My favorite was a friend of mine who did a project called Coveting, and in his defamed painting, Coveting, he took Van Gogh's famous sunflowers, and all he did was snip out a very, very small section of the painting in the form of like an empty puzzle piece, maybe 1/100th of the painting toward the lower corner. That's all he did, and it was labeled Coveting. And what he noticed, and certainly this was his intention, is that everybody's eyes were drawn not to the 99% of the painting that was beautiful and intact, but everybody's eyes were drawn to the tiny little missing puzzle piece that looked black in the corner of the painting. The message of the painting was something like, if I just had that one little piece, this thing would be flawless. And it was supposed to communicate something about the nature of coveting. I can have a million great things, but one thing I lack. So we're talking about coveting today. It's an idea that basically says, I have a missing piece in my life, and I have to find it. I have to possess it in order to be fully me. So the 10th commandment in its fullness reads this way: you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything else that is your neighbor's. Regarding that commandment, let me mention three things. I want to talk about the attitude, the neighbor, and the assets. But I'll begin with the attitude because, in a sense, this commandment does something unusual, something very different from the other commandments. It seeks to prevent an attitude, a disposition, a way of understanding, a way of thinking, believing, feeling. The 10th commandment doesn't focus upon outward actions like the other commandments. Like, it doesn't deal with molding idols or stealing things from someone's purse or murdering your enemy or committing adultery. Hands don't covet, hearts do. And it's fascinating that this last commandment deals most squarely with the heart, not just with the behavior, but the heart behind the behavior. Now, the Old Testament legal material, in general, focuses upon outward action, on doing or not doing. But sometimes it digs deeper into psychology or motive or into the attitudes of the heart. This is why it says in Deuteronomy that you have to circumcise your hearts. Right? It isn't just enough to go through a bodily ritual. It's something about your internal life that needs to be cleaned up and purified. Martin Luther famously said that this particular commandment, the 10th commandment, was placed at the end of the list for this reason. He writes, "The last commandment is addressed not to those whom the world considers wicked rogues, but precisely to the upright, to people who wish to be commended as honest and virtuous because they have not offended against the preceding commandments. Such is nature that we, all of us, begrudge someone else for having what we ourselves desire." So whether or not you think you passed the test of the first 9 commandments, you haven't. Neither have I. You certainly can't get past the 10th one because it's just so invasive on the face of it. So it's about an attitude, the attitude of coveting. Now, the Hebrew word for the attitude of coveting is important to mention because it has a lot of flexibility to it. It's derived from the Hebrew word chamad. Chamad means to desire or long for. And here's the problem with the word, at least for our consideration today. Chamad, or chamad, I just can't pronounce that very well, chamad, it can be both positive or negative. In the 10th commandment, chamad is clearly negative. Do not covet, thus and such. But in other passages, it's quite noble. For example, in Genesis 2, verse 9, out of the ground the Lord God made to spring up every tree that is pleasant, or chamad, to the sight and good for food. He's describing something that is wonderful and that you should want to participate in. Also, Psalm 19, the Lord's decrees are more to be desired, or chamad, than they are gold. I mean, the person that wants these things, pursues these things, is doing something of the highest value. You ought to desire those things or covet those things. And here's the problem. The 10th commandment could be translated, you shall not desire. You shall not desire. You shall not long for. And if the commandment stopped there, that would be somewhat problematic because desire in and of itself is often quite good. You ought to desire certain things. If you are hungry, you ought to desire to come to Manja Fest and we will feed you. If you play sports, you ought to long for, desire, chamad, to play with your heart and win. That's a good desire. Sexual desire can be very healthy. Self-betterment can be healthy. Those desires within you are very often placed in you by God. And seeking after a solution or fulfillment of those desires isn't necessarily a bad thing. The crisis resides not in the desire itself, but in what you desire, what I desire. And that's why we can't cut off the commandment as our summary did earlier in our service, you shall not covet, you shall not desire, you shall not chamad, because it's directly connected to something or many things, particularly things that belong to your neighbor. That's where the problem comes in. So that's the attitude. This sin is about attitude, but attitude attached to, second point of the sermon, your neighbor. The emphasis of the 10th commandment, based on word repetition and possessives, is not on coveting. The emphasis of this commandment is on your neighbor, because it repeats the word neighbor 3 times and possessives 4 times. We'll read it again. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. Here is the problem, right? When you desire, long for, not something in general, but something specific that is owned by a specific person, someone else, and you believe that's the missing piece in Van Gogh's sunflowers. If I just had that they have clutched in their own hands, if I could clutch it and I could claim it, then my life would be completely solvent. That's where the crisis resides, in wishing to own that which someone else owns. Now, note 2 things about this neighbor language. First, the 10th commandment, in a real sense, presumes private stewardship. I wouldn't say private ownership because none of us owns anything completely, because everything in God's world belongs to God. You steward things and I steward things and we do so temporarily. But private stewardship and the things that things are temporarily owned or stewarded in this life, not by a king, not by a priest, they don't own everything. Your neighbor owns certain things and you own certain things. The 10th commandment presumes that. Also, the 10th commandment, by using the language of neighbor, presumes nearness, because a neighbor lives, well, nearby. You know them, you know their house, you know when they put out their recycling bins, you know when they are too loud and yelling at their children. Now, this commandment could have been abstract, don't covet anyone's stuff, but it doesn't say anyone. It says your neighbor. Now, that can be, of course, understood in somewhat generalized terms, but I think the language is somewhat deliberate here. Emperor Marcus Aurelius used to say about coveting this fascinating little comment. He says, we begin to covet that which we see every day. That is what your eyes roll over every day, what you see through windows, over fences, on Instagram, what you keep clicking on, you begin to covet because that is what hits your retinas again and again, and it sinks into the heart through the retinas. And there's, of course, a myriad of biblical stories that center upon the sin of coveting. I think one of the most famous is David's adultery. The sin isn't just adultery, it's covetousness. Because David had this posh life, living in a posh house, and he decided to get a little lazy and not head off with the troops into war like all monarchs did. Instead, he stayed back, looked out his window at night, and saw somebody bathing on a roof next to him. And he thought, I don't have enough. That's the missing piece to Van Gogh's sunflowers, and I deserve it. And I'm going to take it. And if anybody stands in my way, i.e. her husband, what's one less husband in the world? If he needs to be bumped off, we bump him off. And he did. And it went downhill even further from there. I remember talking to a minister of a very fancy church in Manhattan who said, we were talking about challenging pastoral cases and where we felt we were out of our depth, and he said, the problem with me is all the models at my church. And I'm like, wait, what? Evidently, he had a lot of people on runways, you know, who attended services there, and they liked the church, and they felt very accepted there, and he said, I don't know really how to help them because they hate themselves so deeply. I'm like, what? I mean, they're incredibly rich. And they're all beautiful by earthly standards, right? They're beautiful. They're on the front, the covers of magazines. And he said, oh, they don't feel that way. He said, they're all on enormous amounts of anti-anxiety medication and depression meds. And they're, because they're often comparing themselves to one another, right? And why they didn't get certain magazine deals, why they weren't on certain runways, if they just lost 3 more pounds, etc. And so he said there's a lot of self-loathing in that community. He said the very people that you think are at the top of the game and the most beautiful in the world do not feel that way. And it's because of that comparison. And they're comparing themselves to their neighbors and feeling very deeply flawed and coveting what their neighbor has or what they think their neighbor has. And so what I want to say to you in a nutshell is it's not wrong to desire good things. It's healthy to desire. It's healthy to covet, if you will, or hamad, good things. If it's right to desire a healthy, better marriage. It's right to want physical health and mental health. It's right to want a cleaner house. It's right to want a car that works. That would be a wonderful thing, right? It's a good thing to want these things. But when it gets too specific and you're starting to covet those things that specifically belong to someone else, they're stewarded by someone else for this time, the danger with that is it means that you begin to believe a fantastical lie about your own life. You begin to think because you have this absence in your life, you don't have what they have in this one area, you begin to think, I'm not fully legitimate, and I'm not handsome, and I'm not pretty, and I'm not wealthy, and I'm not impressive, and I'm not successful until I possess what they possess. That is the missing piece. And if I just had that, I know not everything would be better, but 90% of it would be. Yeah. Well, that's the idea behind this commandment. It's the attitude attached to the neighbor. I must possess what the person I see every day possesses. And what do they possess? Well, the commandment here becomes very invasive because it talks a lot about assets that this other person might own. So we're shifting from attitude to neighbor to the neighbor's assets because the 10th commandment is invasive. It doesn't talk about coveting neighbor's goods in general. It mentions all these specifics about what your neighbor might own, at least within that time. Some of the assets are personal, some of them material. It talks about persons like spouses and employees, manservants, maidservants, that kind of thing. By the way, this is a very brief excursus, but not an unimportant one. This is very controversial in certain circles. You should not covet your neighbor's wife. The assumption that some have is, see, you're saying that a wife is the property of her husband, completely owned by her husband, therefore not a full person, ought not to be regarded as a full person. This is evidence of the patriarchy, etc. Now, I'm not denying that there are some patriarchal crazy things out there. I'm not denying that. I'm just saying this isn't one of them, because in 1 Corinthians 7 in the New Testament, it goes a step further. Which you may know, yeah? It talks about marriage in 1 Corinthians 7. This is what it says. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Meaning, within this framework, there's a mutual belonging that your wife belongs to you as the husband, and you belong to your wife, right? That's just what our understanding of marriage is, and that's reflected here in this commandment. But it's saying you can't lust after, crave after, plot to gain people that belong to somebody else, because they don't belong to you in this temporary stewardship. But it mentions other things, like impersonal things or material things, like a house. There's a lot of craving after houses. By the way, I sort of did this recently. So I was in Ocean Grove thanks to the Shepsons. They let us stay at the place that they temporarily had out there, and I got to walk through the streets of New Jersey beach towns. I want 8 bathrooms. I only have 5 people in my house, but I don't think it's too much to ask for to want 8 bathrooms. I mean, these houses were all palatial and beautiful and beachfront, and they all had like crow's nests on top where you could like see sunsets. But I live in Grove City where there's not sunlight. And so I was, you know, maybe a little coveted. I don't know. I have to discern it. But he gets specific. You can't lust after your neighbor's house just because they have a two-stall garage. Then he says, you can't want your neighbor's donkey. I think that's sort of funny until I remember that's transportation, right? In that century, that's transportation. That's how Jesus got into Jerusalem, you know, it's the donkey. So that's your Tesla. You can't want the Tesla that your neighbor has, or the Ford Focus if you're really tempted. Or the ox. What is an ox? An ox is what you use to plow fields. That means employment. You can't just want the job that your neighbor has, because your neighbor has his own job. Right? And then if those don't hit you, like a person that you're lusting after, a house, transportation, or a job, it says anything. You can't want anything, lust after anything, covet anything that is your neighbor's, which is a rather all-encompassing term. Meaning, if it's under your neighbor's temporary dominion, it's not yours. This commandment gets specific, in other words, it starts meddling with particular assets that we regard as treasurable, persons we know, faces we can see, locations we love, rooms we adore. It says, not only hands off, but hearts off. It's not yours. And what's interesting about this particular passage and what it mentions as assets, houses and wives and employees and transportation, all of these are fairly ordinary objects. It doesn't say, notice, don't covet the king's palace. Don't covet the resolute desk in the White House. Don't covet Amazon.com ownership. It mentions simple things that many people have. Why? Because it's what we see every day. It's what the neighbors own. And so this commandment is very invasive when it speaks about assets. And so that's something about the attitude, covetousness of this commandment, something about neighbor, something about assets. And now I want to land it for us, hopefully in a compelling way. Coveting stretches forth for what it regards as the missing piece, to grasp the missing piece of the painting. And here's the truth that underlines the sin of coveting. We do, in fact, all of us, have a missing piece to the masterpiece. We do have a missing piece inside us. But that missing piece is not someone else's clean basement or their vacation spot or their mental health or their intelligence or their spouse or their smiley children that we mistakenly think are smiley all the time. That is not the missing piece. Would it help us a little? Sometimes, but it's not the missing piece. St. Paul, in the New Testament, in the fourth chapter of Philippians, talks about the missing piece that gave him, in his mid-40s, great contentment. And this is what he writes in Philippians chapter 4 about the secret to letting go of covetousness and to finding contentment. This is the missing piece. I have learned, Paul writes, in whatever situation I am in, to be content. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. For I can do all things through him who strengthens me. Paul lost so much in his life. People think of him as this driven, type A person who would just was sort of on top of his game all the time. No, he lost his reputation. He lost his wealth. He lost his safety. He lost his homeland. All within a very brief span of time. What did he have that kept him content? Paul knew the Christ who was the non-coveter. He knew the Christ who was immune from coveting. This Christ could have had it all, but didn't clutch. And this is what he writes earlier in Philippians about this Christ, that he, who is equal to God, didn't count equality with Yahweh as something to be clutched and held on to, but he emptied himself and became a servant even to the point of death. This is a Christ whom Paul knew, who gave him strength regardless of his changing times. It's a Christ who is for Paul. It's a Christ who is for you when you are broke and when you're rich, when you are terminal and when you are healthy, when you are smart and when you're ignorant, when our kids love us and when they don't. It's the Christ who is resiliently for us. That's the secret, is knowing him and leaning into him who gave it all away, is the way that we ourselves can lose some of our covetousness. You know, the Puritans called this missing piece, the Christ at the center, they called this missing piece the new affection. Isn't that lovely? The new affection. That is the warmth of God that places itself in your own troubled life. In fact, the Puritans wrote about what they called the expulsive power of the new affection. Meaning when you begin to receive real love that is unconditional in its cruciform nature, it has the power to dissolve and kill sin, to expel it from our lives. When we are loved by the enduring sacrifice of heaven with all of our many problems, it expels evil. It has the power to cast off lesser loves. So one little story about art, and then I'm done. I took this, again, art course at Bryn Mawr University, and we were doing charcoal drawings. And we were doing charcoal drawings, the professor. Her name was Professor Linda, but I don't remember her last name. And she wanted us to call her by her first name, but add professor. So Professor Linda wanted us to draw hands and eyes, because in some ways they're the most challenging things to draw, at least getting all the proportions right, particularly with hands. So we were drawing an eye from a particular a newspaper clipping. And it was a close-up of this woman's face, and we were just drawing the eyes. And I was working very diligently on this. I mean, it took us hours and hours of very fine-tuned work, because there was a contest at a nearby university, Temple University in Philly. And if your project was chosen, it would be put in a public exhibition in Temple University. And I really wanted to get, you know, some bang for this buck. I wanted to win. I desperately wanted to win. And I was doing very well I'll have you know. My picture looked incredible. But then Dr. Linda, or Professor Linda, was walking behind us giving comments, and she was always very acerbic with her critiques. But with mine, she stood back and said, huh, commendable. I'm like, yeah, it is commendable. I like it too. Thank you very much. But the problem is that the person next to me, whose drawing I couldn't really see, her name was Jolene, by the way, she looks at Jolene's drawing and she says, oh, supreme. Now the thing is, I'm not linguistically brilliant, but I think supreme is better than commendable, because it is. And I didn't like that. And of course, Jolene, she was a genius. Her drawings were so good that they looked like a black and white photograph. You know what I mean? The people that are so, her proportionality, her shading, her use of contrast was unmatched. She just had innate gifts, but ones that were honed over years of practice. And so what did I do? I coveted because I wanted to win, and I wanted the money, and I wanted the prestige, and Jolene won the contest, and I was covetous, and I was quite resentful that I didn't win. And I knew that no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't perfect my craft well enough to overcome what she did. And my professor eventually noticed my little sulky attitude and said, like a week later, Ethan, if you are only content when you are the best in our department, then you're doomed, kid. She said, it's not about you being better than her. It's about you being better than you were 6 months ago. And this was not a Christian college, but she said these words, don't you understand? God is honing you. God's honing you. And that really helped me. It helped me reframe, you know, to see it a little differently. And then I decided to go to Jolene's exhibition at Temple University, and I honestly remember in my heart being happy for her and losing the resentment. I was happy for her because she did do a better job, and now people could see it and be inspired by it. And I thought then at that time, you know, we all shine. Her art is better than mine, and I have better hair than her. But that changed too. It's okay, who cares? God is honing you, right? Those loving, life-giving words. Well, that was a little sampling of a new affection, because when you have the lavish love of Christ, it is the cure for coveting, because it says that we are all right, regardless of what we have or don't have, because we are defined foundationally by justifying love. Well, this same affection can also make us quite happy when other people have what we don't have, because they're going to light up the world in their own beautiful way. And they'll say the same of us when we shine. That's what it's like when the Spirit's converting the heart, because isn't it great that I won't ever, Ethan, will not ever be as wealthy as some of you, because you're generous with your wealth and you would manage it better than I would anyway. Isn't it great that Dennis Jacob is more positive than I am, because he's able to light up a room and I'm too sardonic? Isn't it great that Rachel Verbois is a better baker than I'll ever be, because she makes food that I then eat? Isn't it great that T. David knows Greek better than I ever will, because he's helped hundreds of people love the New Testament? Isn't it great that Susan Brown is gutsier than me, because she's an example of gorgeous honesty and resilience that inspires us all in the spite of great difficulty? Isn't it great that Chris Franklin knows more about Boethius than I do? Because that means I don't ever have to read Boethius. I can just ask him what it means. And that's easier. And isn't it great that Jesus Christ fills the missing piece in the masterpiece that is your life and sets us free from sin?
Free at last, they took your life. They could not take your breath.